Welcome to Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle, coming up on the programme this week.
And there was a home base just round from the hospital where I used to work. So I would go there. This is like for about 8 years I used to do this. So I would go and just walk around the home base for an hour. And I didn't even have a garden, so I can't.
Just by doing this, whatever that thing is, you're seeing the world from a slightly different perspective, which removes you from that everyday thing of where you're going to get your toilet rolls from today, yeah. Where you're going to get your petrol from today.
Actually, when you have a severe enduring mental illness, or when you live in a small council property with two children with behavioural problems, for example, all this kind of stuff, actually, you need to be able to get out. You need to be able to go to the park. You need to have social services up and running.
And I'll be reminding you how you can make connections with mental health organisations within your community. It's Mental Health Monday. Hey everyone, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for checking out Mental Health Monday once again. Really great guest for you on the program this week in Dr. Max Pemberton. Now, as part of the program this week, we're going to be talking about a new name for a government department. Bear with me on this one, because Public Health England has changed its name. Instead, it is now the Office for Health Improvement and Disparities. And sitting underneath that is the Mental Health Portfolio, if you like. In particular, a campaign that we've talked about a couple of times on the programme, Every Mind Matters, which is the government's way of offering practical tips and advice for free and also diverting you to services as well. They're encouraging people this year to set up their own mind plan, personalised tips, if you like, to help deal with things like stress and anxiety in everyday life, but also boost your mood, sleep better and feel more in control. Now, we're going to hear from Dr. Max about this and about the difference it can make, as well as a host of other different topics as well. But actually, there's a survey that's come with this which gives a real insight as to where people are at with their mental health, and I think this is always a really interesting sort of insight, if you like. Nearly half of adults in England say the COVID-19 pandemic had a negative impact on their mental well-being. 50-50, I think that was, there or thereabouts. More than a third of adults said they did not know what to do to help improve their mental well-being. That's one in three people who don't know what to do, like, at all. Do you know what to do to improve your mental health and well-being? No, in one in three people. But what about this? Younger adults struggled the most, 57% of those. But really concerning from my point of view is that just under half, around 44%, reported that they too did not know what to do to get help. Now, that's really interesting, because I find that young people are much more open to talk about mental health. But actually, this survey, which is from the Office for Health Improvement and Disparities, actually shows that although young people may be more minded to think about their mental health, we've got evidence here that fewer actually know what they can do about that, which is really concerning, isn't it? The mind plans idea is up there. Every Mind Matters. Type that into your search engine. It's the first thing that comes up. Actually, 3.5 million people have already done one of these since it was created just a couple of years ago. So actually, plenty of people are sort of involved in it. And you may well be seeing in the coming weeks a few famous faces also promoting this. And Stephen Fry, the Mercury Prize winner at Arlo Parks, and also Jay Blades off of The Repair Shop. But you've got the inside track first here on Mental Health Monday. So Dr. Max is our guest, talking about a million and one different things, including that survey and Every Mind Matters, but of course his own personal experience and the work that he does through the NHS, with a genuinely really interesting insight into what things have been like for him, his colleagues and those people who work in hospital environments. It's a fascinating conversation. Dr. Max Pemberton is our guest on this week's Mental Health Monday.
Although I'm a journalist, I also work full-time in the NHS, so I have a very busy outpatient clinic which deals with people with mental health problems. And actually, what I've kind of noticed, and this is kind of borne out by the research that's kind of backed, you know, come out with this campaign, is that actually, although we've the phrase, you know, we're all in this together, actually, people have had really, really different experiences of lockdown and the pandemic in general. Ranging from, you know, some of my patients who've got very severe enduring mental illness, but maybe really struggled with social anxiety, actually, they've had relatively a good pandemic, in the sense that they've been shielding, they've been staying at home, and actually it's kept their anxiety relatively low. And now the difficulty they're facing, of course, is having to suddenly, after 18 months of being at home and maybe got a bit habituated, getting very used to staying at home, now all of a sudden they have to be expected to go back out again and meet their family and friends and maybe go back out to work. So their anxiety has gone right up. The flip side of that is I've had other patients who actually really struggled during the pandemic, and actually that's left a kind of legacy, a kind of enduring pattern of difficulties. And actually, it's some of the patients have been very lonely. They've been experienced real isolation, which has compounded some of the feelings, like, you know, so if they've had depression, for example. But also patients, maybe for example, who have eating disorders, who've suddenly had to spend a lot of time with family members, maybe kind of being feeling very scrutinized, having lots of, you know, the kind of usual adaptive patterns that they've got suddenly being taken away from them, and being in this kind of pressure cooker kind of situation with their family. So for one set of situation, one set of circumstances, for one person might actually be okay. And what we've seen is actually for someone else, really does down to their kind of, you know, their personality characteristics, their kind of mental health history and so on, actually has been very, very difficult. And I found this myself, you know, I was going to work during the pandemic every day. So I was going into hospital, and actually that was the kind of anxiety, having to get public transport, sort of seeing loads of people, lots of people being sick all around me and so on and so on. And yet some of my friends were either furloughed or immediately sent home to work from home. And actually their problem was quite the opposite. So even though we were all having the same pandemic, actually our kind of experiences, just because of, you know, who we are and our jobs and so on, were very, very different.
I think that was the phrase, wasn't it? We're all in this together. And then I think it changed to something which was probably more true to life, which was, we're all in the same storm, but we're not all in the same boat.
Yes, that's exactly right. In fact, one of the receptionists sent this round at work, because also even within the health service, some of my colleagues were sent home. So they were working from home. And yet you got, for example, the cleaners or the people that work in the canteen or the receptionists, they still had to stay there. So it was a very odd mix of people. And this is exactly it. So, you know, some of the frontline clinicians were sent home. And so they were having, still, even though they were considered, you know, they're working for the NHS and everyone's clapping for them and so on, actually they were having a very, very different experience to a cleaner who's having to walk around. And actually, I remember during the lockdown, turning around, and as I walked around past the toilet, a cleaner came out, she'd been crying in the toilets. And I know her kind of fairly well. And I was chatting to her, saying, what's wrong? Are you okay? And she was saying, I'm just so scared. I've got three children, and I'm really scared about this virus. And, you know, I'm the one that is cleaning, that's supposed to be doing the cleaning. So I'm definitely coming into contact with the virus. And I realized, I thought, goodness, yeah. You know, and also very, people are often, in those situations, often easily forgotten. I think, again, during the pandemic, there was a lot of kind of hero worship, almost, the kind of doctors and nurses. But actually, we forgot about the people like the delivery drivers or the people working in factories, all those people who are also on the front line and also in very scary situations. So, yeah, so I think overall, it's been very different people's experiences, this, but certainly we know that it's had quite a profound impact for lots of different reasons on people's mental health.
I think so, absolutely. And I think that's the other thing as well about how we perceive, because I think there was this NHS, you know, heroes wearing capes, but I also spoke to NHS staff, you know, who were like taking off all their clothes at the back door and walking into the house naked, because they didn't want it. And you think, well, that's not the bit on Superman that you see, is it? That's the bit where somebody's literally petrified of bringing something into their home environment. You touched on it as well with the cleaner as well.
That is literally, so one of my very, very dear friends, Sarah, she is an orthopedic surgeon. She works at Great Ormond Street. She's a very specialist surgeon. And because she's so specialist, they closed her department and she got redeployed onto a COVID intensive care unit. And she has got four children, all young children under the age of 10. And she actually, she popped round and she was telling me about what it was like in the first kind of 2 months. And she did exactly this. She was so scared, and she's very sensible. You know, she's a really kind of, you know, kind of tough. She's a tough woman. And she was saying that she would get literally changed down to her bra and knickers on the doorstep. She would then walk straight through the house, and the children had to shut themselves in the front room. And she could put everything straight into the washing machine. She'd go upstairs, have a shower, and then they could like then say hi to mummy and all this kind of stuff. And I was sitting thinking, I was living on my own. So I was just like, my goodness, this, what a horrible, horrible situation. And of course, then we realized that it maybe wasn't quite as scary as we thought it was and so on, and things could relax a bit. Certainly, it's easy to forget. And that, surely, that kind of stress and pressure would have an enduring effect on people, even though we might then be able to calm down a bit.
Can I show you that? When we talk about mental health, is that sort of almost like that first-hand experience, which of course has a you have to react to it because it's happening and it's in front of you, you're making a decision. But you mentioned it before, and I've heard it said quite a few times in the conversations I've had about the impact of the pandemic. For instance, eating disorders, which I guess was, it was one of the unknowns. Maybe there were people sort of warning that this could potentially be a problem. But I guess when we look at consequences of lockdowns and the pandemic, things like a rise in eating disorders, or particularly a negative experience of those living with eating disorders, are one of those things which we will now have to make provision for, and make, you know, that we maybe weren't expecting to be a direct consequence of this airborne, you know, toxic event that was going on.
Yeah. Well, actually, interestingly, so I until last year, the pandemic made me change my career a bit. So I've now worked with older people just because, I don't know, that's another story. I sort of felt very sort of passionate and connected to kind of older people, having worked on a COVID ward. But before that, I spent 10 years working in an eating disorder unit. So actually, I was very aware of this, and actually all my colleagues were very aware of it. And because it's a very specialist service, it got pretty much closed down. And we had to discharge a lot of patients. And some of these patients I've known literally for 10 years. You know, I know their mobile phone numbers off by heart. I know their date of birth, you know, all this kind of stuff. You know, I know them incredibly, incredibly well. And I was just devastated, thinking, these people won't be able to manage. And actually what I noticed happening, particularly the eating disorder patients, is that there was this, one of the kind of sometimes personality traits is very low self-esteem, low sense of self-worth. So actually initially all the conversations were like, of course you must go, of course, you know, we've got to close down the service, don't worry about us, doctor, it's all going to be okay, you know, there's people much worse off than I am. Very, very much so. And I'm sure that happened in other patient groups, but this was very clear in this patient group. There's a lot of that conversations. And actually, even though I was working on a COVID ward, I still kept up with my patients and called them quite regularly, even though they'd technically been discharged from the service, just to see how they were. And actually, what I noticed over the months, actually, that changed. And they were saying, actually, Max, I'm really struggling. And then I started getting phone calls from parents, again, many of whom I know very well, saying, this is a nightmare. We, you know, because of course, people think sometimes erroneously with eating disorders, it's about, you know, kind of body image and looking thin and so on, but actually it's not. It's typically about control and coping strategy. It's an unhelpful coping strategy. So of course you put somebody in a situation where maybe they can't over-exercise, they can't control their food, et cetera, et cetera. And actually they then panicking even more, they feel out of control, you know, their usual routine and structures have gone, they feel out of control. So for a group of those patients, it was a very catastrophic thing. And we had very honest and difficult conversations within the doctors, saying actually the consequence of lockdown will mean that people will die. And actually some of our patients will die, and indeed did die. Across mental health services, you know, they pretty much closed down, certainly for the first couple of months. And we knew that you know, people needed to be monitored and supported and so on. And if we just all retracted, that there would be consequences. And I wrote quite a lot about this, because I felt that it's easy to kind of push for more lockdown when you kind of are having Zoom cocktails with your family and baking banana bread and you've got a lovely garden. Actually, when you have a severe enduring mental illness, or when you live in a small council property with two children with behavioural problems, for example, all this kind of stuff, actually, you need to be able to get out, you need to be able to go to the park, you need to have social services up and running. And I felt it was quite a middle class thing of kind of pushing for more lockdown. In fact, there was a quote I read, Julie Birchall wrote, there was no such thing as a lockdown, only middle class people getting poor people to bring them things. And I've kind of felt that very strongly on the front line, was actually that my patients, their voice, it was an impossible, difficult balancing act. But their voice, the kind of poor people, I felt wasn't particularly being heard, and the needs that they had. But anyway, so it's been a very complex time, I think, for people, which is why, to bring it back to why I'm here, which is why this kind of campaign is so important, because, you know, the research that the Office for Health and Disparities, is that right?
Health improvement.
Health improvement and disparities. That's right. But actually, I think it's an interesting title, because I think the idea of disparities, the inequality that is existing, I think that the pandemic's really shown that. So the research that's kind of come out of that is very much showed that actually people felt a bit lost. They didn't know where to go for help. They weren't sure. They knew there was all these resources out there. They weren't quite sure where they were. So the idea of this Better Health Every Mind Matters campaign is to kind of pull together all those resources so that people just had basically one place they knew where they could go to get everything, to get signposted on, to get some help. There's a part of the website where you can answer some questions, and it helps people develop what they call a mind plan, to kind of basically sort of help self-help kind of toolkit of things that are going to help you with your kind of mental resilience, your mental well-being. So things like that, right through to kind of other stuff that maybe isn't directly related to mental health, but we know has an impact on mental health. Things like, you know, financial problems, employment, housing, things like that. So to kind of signpost people on. So we've been really lucky because we've got all the main mental health charities kind of supporting us and giving us resources and so on.
Absolutely. And Every Mind Matters, which has been talked about and has been there for a number of years, actually. But actually, I think the fact that it's there, that mind plan opportunity is there as well, fits in quite nicely with actually with some of the survey results that as part of launch, that actually one in three people don't know what to do if they're struggling. So you got a high proportion of people there. I think something like half of people said that their mental health have been negative. A third of them literally don't know what to do. And I think we sometimes live in a world where, because people say, oh, it's okay to not be okay. Like some people might hear that and go, all right, fine, I don't feel okay. But I think a lot of people will go, well, okay, but so what, but what next? What's yeah. the thing? Where do you turn to? And actually when people do the mind plan, you don't have to be in a crisis to find a good way into, you know, positive mental health.
Exactly. And I think
that's certainly a good point that's worth making, particularly people who are having a good time of it, so that if they do fall on bad times, they already know a potential pathway out.
Exactly. And I think that's the thing, that there is an element to the whole Every Mind Matters campaign. There is an element which is like, okay, so you're in a crisis, you're having a difficulty, these are the services that you need to go off and help you, and that might be there to support you. But actually, I think the idea of it is that before it gets to that stage, so before people are having a crisis or they're struggling, it's actually about kind of saying, okay, well, what works for you? Like what kind of self-help things can you do, or can you, what tools can you have, like almost like in the kit bag, kind of preparing, kind of, you know, for if you have a bit of a wobble, if things are a bit difficult. So actually before it's got to kind of you actually having a mental illness, when you're just having a bit of distress, a bit of difficulty, which everybody does, every single person would experience that kind of, you know, having a bit of a difficult time, what things are going to particularly help you to make people, I suppose, in the kind of, you know, kind of in a calm sort of cold light of day, you know, what sort of things do you go to that, you know, kind of make you feel a bit better? So like for me, for example, I love walking into, so I live in central London, but I can walk into by the National Gallery. So I go to the National Gallery. I don't know anything about art, but I will go and just sit in a room, and I know why that works. It's because when I was a little kid, my mum used to do it with me. So it reminds me of like it's a very nice kind of warming, kind of lovely feeling. So I don't have to even look at the pictures particularly. There's a couple of rooms I tend to go to. So if I, you know, it's just if I've had a difficult day at work and so on. There's another thing I always do. I go to Homebase, which I know sounds a bit strange. I go to Homebase, and I used to every single Thursday. I used to have a very stressful day on a Thursday. And I used to see a lot of patients. It was all very difficult and so on. See my most complex patients on a Thursday. And I found myself, I used to get home, I feel kind of just like I struggled to turn off. And there was a Homebase just round from the hospital where I used to work. So I would go there. This is like for about 8 years I used to do this. So I would go and just walk around the Homebase for an hour. And I didn't even have a garden, so I couldn't do anything, but I definitely know what lawnmower I would buy if I ever did have a garden. And I'd sort of just be very mindful, sort of like looking at the stuff. And in a way, I quite liked the fact I couldn't buy anything because I didn't have a garden, because it kind of took away that pressure of like, oh, maybe I should buy this, maybe I should buy that. And I just walk around for an hour, and then I treat myself to a taxi home. And it was just that really simple thing. And I just sort of fell upon it. I never realized that that's what I was doing. But I started to really look forward to Thursdays, even though they were my most difficult day, because then I got to have this nice, very thoughtful, peaceful, quite meditative time walking around Homebase. And actually, just before I left that job, actually, this woman came up to me and said, who worked there, I said, can I ask you, what are you doing here? And I said, what are you interested? We've seen you. You always come here every Thursday, and we're having bets on why you do this. We, for a long time, we thought you were scoping it out and you're going to do shoplifting. And I was like, I knew I used to get followed around by security. And I explained to her, and it was really interesting. And she was saying, actually, I do that a lot. She was saying, I go to Topshop quite a lot and just will walk around, just wander around. So it's just lots of little silly things like that, all sorts of stuff that are your kind of personal go-to for like keeping you calm, maybe, you know, giving you a bit of like a time out of your life kind of thing.
I think that's such a great shout, that as well. And I've spoken a lot in the program about GPs doing social prescriptions. So I'll recommend in the future that, you know, few laps of Homebase might be something we could add to the list, alongside the knitting clubs and the sport five aside and the dramatic sort of the drama groups and things like that. But can I ask you about young people as well?
Yeah.
Because young people, I know in terms of the work that I do, are much more open to conversations around mental health and don't see some of the stigma that our generation probably did. And yet the numbers were, I'll say, worse for them in terms of knowing what to do. So they, in many ways, they were aware of the conversation around mental health and it's okay not to be okay and so on and so forth. But actually, they were less likely to know where to turn. And actually, generationally, if they are much more open-minded to it, that's a great time, isn't it? To then say, well, and here's the offer. So we've got to get that right with that young generation, because otherwise they'll go, we talk about this and we're aware of it, but actually we don't know what to do with it. And that's a problem if we don't get it right, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And my other concern about that is, unfortunately, social media can be an amazing force for good, you know, where a lot of youngsters spend a lot of time, can be an amazing force for good. But I know from working in eating disorders and also working with teenagers, particularly who self-harm, there is also, unfortunately, an element that is much more toxic on social media. And my concern is that people, you know, we kind of encourage these people to have this conversation and to be very open and so on and so on. But actually, if they're doing that particularly on social media, they can stumble across stuff that is actually counterproductive, actually very unhelpful. So they're kind of exposing themselves in a way, but sort of talking about how they're feeling and so on, but actually that opens them up in various ways for very unhelpful kind of input. And so it's really important we kind of signpost them. I thought that the research that came out of this was interesting, that showed that they were the cohort that had struggled most out of the pandemic. Because I was actually talking about this, I was giving a talk yesterday to some older people, and I was saying, why is this? Because I would have imagined older people, they're the ones who are sat at home, they're at, you know, higher risk of the virus, so it's scarier for them, they're more likely to have to socially isolate, they've got medical complications, they're in chronic pain, all sorts of things like this, which we know make things much harder for people. So you would have thought that cohort would have been the ones that are struggling, and actually the general kind of feeling was, well, firstly, they've been around longer. So actually they're more used to kind of mobilizing resources, just literally by the dint they've been around. So they're more used to kind of saying, actually, hang on, what can I do? And, you know, who can I ask and so on and so on. And kind of just knowing kind of who might be able to help and who might not be able to help. But I suppose also there's a kind of general feeling of the longer you've been around, and particularly that generation, an older generation, maybe have built up coping strategies and resilience. And actually, I suppose partly it's maybe just a generational thing, that literally the younger you are, the less exposure you've had to traumatic events, so you're less likely to have coping strategies. But also there might be a thing that generationally the older generation did have to endure more kind of harsh realities. Some of the stories that people were telling me in this talk, you know, they were saying, you know, I remember my mum, you know, before the NHS, my mum had to have her teeth removed, you know, without anaesthetic because she couldn't afford it, you know, these really horror stories. And you think, God, and you know, I get upset when WhatsApp's down for like 4 hours, you know. It's like, you know, so maybe actually the sort of, it was interesting, the sort of general discussion amongst this older people were saying, well, actually, you know, we just kind of harked back to our parents and, you know, kind of, you know, the older, even older people, you know, the kind of war generation were kind of saying, well, actually, this, we're used to a bit of harsh, you know, harshness in life and a bit of hardship. So it could also just be that they're more used to it. But certainly it seemed from this research that it was the kind of 18 to 34 year olds that had really significantly struggled. And I think, to be honest, within that, if we were to break that number down, because it's a bit, that's fairly big grouping, probably I would have imagined that 18 to about 24s struggled the most, I would have thought. And I think partly that was also down to the university situation. I was actually during part of the beginning part of the pandemic, they put me in a hotel. And actually the hotel, oddly, looked onto student accommodation. And I could just see every night I come home from work, and of course I've been out of work and I come back, and I could just see all these little rooms, and they just had almost like little kind of rabbit hutches. And they just had all these people just sitting there stooped over their, these students kind of stooped over their laptops. And it was just a really horrible image. And I thought, God, these poor people, and they were kind of stuck in there. They weren't allowed out. And I thought, this is awful. Imagine being 18 or 19, your first kind of experience of university, and you're kind of literally trapped. Like, I felt very sort of strongly for them. I thought, what a miserable time. And you're kind of first time away from your parents, and you're having to do everything over the internet. It's miserable.
In terms of the public messages on the public messaging on this, and we're talking about it now, Every Mind Matters, type that into any search engine, it's the first thing that comes up. It's so important that people know where those resources are, because I think when we touch on, you know, young people that hinted at it there in terms of, you know, certain hashtags take you down certain algorithmic routes and so on and so forth. If we likened it to some other public health and safety messaging, like in the past, when you say don't run across the road, you don't run across the road, and here's why you don't run across the road. But in the past, there was never like someone also telling you, oh yeah, run across the road. Like, run.
Yeah, is it, that's now so true.
Young people are now dealing with that thing whereby if we don't make this voice of here's how you can cope, here's where you can get help if you're struggling, then actually the other voice, which is, that becomes louder. And actually it needs to be drowned out, doesn't it, by the positivity, because those algorithms will come and will come looking for you if it's not outweighed by something which is much more positive and something which is shining a light on something, as opposed to something else, which is essentially opening, you know, a dark cupboard under the stairs. And we've got to get that right, haven't we?
I think it's interesting. I mean, that's such a good analogy. It's true. You know, you get that. You know, I remember when I was a kid, and they were like, don't run on the railways. And there was nobody going, actually, you do. Like, we never had that. There's just a very consistent public health message. And I suppose what I often find interesting within mental health is that, unfortunately, there's a lot of kind of quackery that goes on. And I think it's complicated reasons for that, probably because medicine hasn't always held mental health up as being particularly important, that often it was a kind of Cinderella profession for years and years and years and years and years, that lots of the medications and treatments we have maybe aren't entirely effective, or you need kind of a bit of a scattergun approach sometimes to try and get the one that's right for the individual, which kind of opens up a lot of question marks, but unfortunately allows a lot of kind of, I think, quackery to kind of creep in. And what's interesting, and also people who actually, you know, want to do somebody else harm. And what's interesting is that in other areas of medicine, that is illegal. So if I was to stand up and say I found a cure for cancer, that is against the law. It's the Cancer Act from the 18 something, whatever it's Cancer Act. It's against the law to say that you have a cure for cancer if you don't. And I think it's astonishing that we don't have something in mental health so that you can sit there and you can take suicidal people and you can encourage them to behave in particular ways, or you can encourage people to self-harm and all this kind of stuff. And there's no intervention for that. It seems to be a very odd kind of loophole in public health law. It seems strange. And that is why I feel so passionate about this campaign, is that I want people, I really hate the idea that anybody is suffering or having a difficult time for want of just knowing what to put into a search engine. It would be absolutely heartbreaking, I think, if people were to be struggling at home when there's all of these amazing resources out there, and people have spent so long trying to pull everything together and make it straightforward for people as possible. It is difficult when people are struggling with mental health problems. It is hard. There is no panacea. There's no magic wand. But we know that, you know, that mental health and mental difficulties are, people get better from them, and that there's loads of hope there. And part of the job maybe of professionals like me is to hold hope for people when they maybe feel a bit hopeless. And so that's part of maybe this campaign, is kind of saying to people, like, it's going to be okay. Well done for reaching out. And, you know, we're going to help you.
And it comes with the OHID, almost an NHS sort of Public Health England. So much straightforward, but forget, we're not there anymore. I think that's the thing when we touch on those, like a kite mark, a standard. I think people will look to this and go, oh, this isn't some guru offering me some advice on LinkedIn or something like that. You know, this is actual stuff which has got a scientific basis to it. And that's very important, isn't it?
Yep, it's evidence-based, and it's got the backing of the NHS. So although it's another government body, it's got the backing of the NHS, and we work very closely with the NHS on this, and it's endorsed by it, and also by the main mental health charities as well.
Absolutely. Your home-based thing, by the way, I just noticed in the survey that the vast majority, 60%, gardening. So I moved house at the end of 2019 into a house which had a garden, but there was nothing there. So I had this blank canvas, and I was working throughout the whole of the pandemic, by the way, but like I had this like thing where I could go somewhere, and all that thing about the long-term planning, what's coming, I was thinking, well, if I'm planting this, I've kind of bought myself 3 months like before this even flowers, or if I chop down this tree, what will it grow, will something else grow in its place? Like, and I found, and I think this is why gardening's really caught on, I think there's an extra 3 million gardeners now than there were before the pandemic, that gardening gives you that thing where actually the next 2 weeks don't necessarily matter that much, because actually the thing you've just done now is for next spring, or you're even thinking ahead to next winter. And yeah, that's one of those sort of mindset things which I'm just about to turn 40. But like straight away, I've gone, oh, and now I'm my dad. but I think that's one of those coping things where your brain goes, oh, actually, no, just by doing this, whatever that thing is, you're seeing the world from a slightly different perspective, which removes you from that everyday thing of where you're going to get your toilet rolls from today, yeah, where you're going to get your petrol from today. It takes you, and I think we can all find that. And I think the plan helps you find those sorts of elements, as well as those sort of like urgent sort of signposting services.
I love that idea. That's interesting about gardening. I haven't thought about it like that, because I suppose it's projecting yourself into the future, which is actually one of the things that we would often do with people who feel very desperate or very suicidal. We would use techniques to kind of to help people do that, because often that's one of the symptoms, is not being able to see yourself in the future. So, but I love that idea. It's like that I think it's a Chinese kind of proverb: the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is today. I love that idea.
That's such a good. But actually, one of the things as well, and I'm almost evangelical about gardening. No, is now, like, when what you learn is that if you put something in the ground, put three plants in there, two of them might die, or they won't look what you. And even that process, I think, helps you sort of think, right, well, I'll learn my lesson for the next time. Whereas I think we kind of live in a world, don't we, a little bit now, where it's, oh, you made a mistake, right, cancelled. Like, oh, you did something wrong, forget it, you should be sacked. Whereas actually in the garden, you can get, planted four of them, and one of them survived. And at least then you think, well, actually, so next year I'll change the soil or something like that. And I think you can learn to fail at the and knowing that it's not the end, it's just a comma, and it's the start of a new thing. Like I say, I think that's why gardening's so popular. I'll stop talking about it now.
I'm going to see you in home base, I can tell.
Absolutely, yeah. But I'm the guy who's actually buying stuff, way too much stuff.
I can give you loads of advice, though. Honestly, I know everything. I know all their stock, like, back of my hand.
Good stuff. Absolute pleasure to speak to you on the program today. Really appreciate you joining us, Dr. Max Pemberton. Every Mind Matters. If you just type that into any search engine, it's the first thing up. The Mind Plan is available there as well, and there's, I'm sure, information on there about the rebranding of the OHID. Don't worry about that for yourself. Dr. Max, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate you joining us.
A pleasure.
I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Thanks for checking out Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. You can find me on Twitter at Mr. Mick Coyle. You can also find me, Mick Coyle, on Facebook as well. Don't forget, if you want to speak to somebody about your mental health, you can do so. The Samaritans, free to call on 116 123. You can find mental health services where you are. Just look for the Hub of Hope. Type in your postcode. It'll find those mental health services close to you. And for support in a crisis, you can text SHOUT to 85258. That's if you're experiencing a personal crisis, you're unable to cope and need support. Shout to 85258. That's a text line. Do get involved in those services. In an absolute emergency, always remember the number to call is 999. Thanks for downloading the podcast this week. We'll be back next week with more Mental Health Monday.